the meeting of the Safety and Operations Committee, first in September, first after a long vacation. Gentlemen, Mr. McCarthy, Mr. Ron, can you take your conversation to the side? Thank you. Let me just make an introductory statement, and then I'll have Mr. Lederer introduce a new member of the WMATA management team. So first, I'd like to note that committee member David Horner has a conflict and has recused himself from the matter regarding the Silver Line Phase 2 issues before the committee today. Alternate federal member Devin Rouse will participate in his place. Mr. Lederer, you want to make an introduction?
Good morning. Today's presentation is an update to the board on the Silver Line Phase 2. Next slide.
I'm sorry. I missed doing some preliminary matters before I can turn it over to you and the general manager and the new chief safety officer. So as to the agenda, if there is no objections, we can consider the agenda approved as presented. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the agenda is approved. Next, we'll just have an approval from the previous minutes of July 25, 2019. So can I ask one of the committee members for a motion to approve the minutes of our last July 25 session?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Second. Thank you, Mr. Bolger. So all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. The minutes are approved as presented. Moving on, we have one major issue on today's agenda, an update on the progress of Phase 2 of the Silver Line. The project is currently under construction, is managed by the Airports Authority, MWA, Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority. Today's presentation will provide an overview of Metro's role and responsibilities in the project, the conditions for Metro's ultimate acceptance of the project, and information about currently known construction quality issues. I'll now turn the floor over to General Manager, Mr. Wiedefeld, the Chief Operating Officer, Joe Lederer, and the Inspector General, Jeff Charrington, to provide an update to the committee. But perhaps, before we get started, the General Manager would like to introduce a new member of the team.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, with us today is our new safety lead. She's part of the executive management team and our chief safety officer, Teresa Mastano. She came from Amtrak and before that, New Jersey Transit, a great lot of experience, and we're very fortunate to get her here as well. And then also, Jeff, if you want to introduce the people that you have for your presentation.
Yes, thank you, General Manager. To my left is Deputy Inspector General Renee Febles, who's leading the OIG's effort on the Silver Line probe. To his left is our expert, Mr. Eldon Tipping of Structural Services, Inc.
Welcome. Welcome to the Metro Board. Welcome to the Safety and Operations Committee meeting.
So, Mr. Lee is going to walk you through basically the presentation, and then if there's any reference to the OIG, they're here to answer any questions for what they've done.
Okay, so just to be clear, the presentation will be done by Mr. Lederer with the assistance of the IG, or the IG will make a separate presentation.
They're here for any questions that you might have.
Very good. As Warner Wolf would show, would say, on with the show, on with the tape.
All right, thank you. Next slide. Okay. Under the cooperative agreement with the Airports Authority, Metro has two fundamental roles on the Silver Line Phase 2. First role is to serve as a technical advisor to the Airport Authority, assisting in the review of design, construction, and testing activities. And in the second role, as the intended owner and operator, Metro determines whether conditions necessary for Metro's acceptance has been satisfied. Metro also manages the design, procurement, and installation of certain capital equipment, as indicated here on the slide. But it's important to remember, Metro has no role in the management of this project, and Metro has no role in the management of the contractors working on this project. Construction of Silver Line Phase 2 is significantly advanced. Facility and civil construction is nearly complete. System installation and testing are well underway. Dynamic testing using metro rail cars has been underway since February of 2019. After dynamic testing, the project will advance through several milestones, moving towards Metro's acceptance and the start of revenue service. System performance demonstration occurs over a period of not less than 30 days and consists of activities conducted by the contractor to demonstrate integration and performance in accordance with the contract requirements under normal, abnormal, and simulated emergency operations. Substantial completion is achieved when the work is completed, except for punch list work, and the project is ready for operational readiness testing. Achievement of substantial completion is determined by the Airport Authority and has certain contractual implications, including the establishment of the beginning of warranty periods. Some examples of the conditions of substantial completion in the contract include the delivery of record documents and spare parts to Metro, completion of contractor training of Metro staff, and the provision of all O&M manuals to Metro. Operational readiness is the date on which Metro determines that the project is significantly complete for Metro to commence simulated rail service. A condition of operational readiness is the successful completion of operational readiness testing conducted by Metro. And pre-revenue activities occur between the operational readiness date and Metro acceptance, and during this period, Metro has provisional care, custody, and control of the project, and performs activities in preparation for revenue service. Some samples of these activities include running simulated service, conducting drills with emergency responders, mobilizing stations, and the rekeying of all facilities that are located in Dulles Yard as well as in the stations themselves. So if you look at the chart, just briefly, the color green means that those are the items that are completed. So right now we are in the period of between static testing and dynamic testing. Next slide. In terms of Metro acceptance, the cooperative agreement between Metro and the Airport Authority for Phase 2 establishes 10 conditions to Metro acceptance of Phase 2. These conditions are summarized in the MEED, which you were provided earlier today. Next slide. It should be noted that on a project of this magnitude, it's not uncommon and, in fact, can be the sign of a healthy QA and QC program for there to be literally thousands of individual non-compliant issues of varying scope identified over the course of the project. That said, the nature of deficiencies identified on the Silver Line Phase 2 caused concern for Metro in terms of potential future impacts to Metro's operation and maintenance costs. Several non-compliance issues identified on the Silver Line Phase 2 have achieved higher profile by inclusion in various media reports, and the following slides provide an update on the status of significant deficiencies.
Mr. Leonard, before you go on to those, of those that are listed, those 10 or 11, which are fairly new in terms of when they, as deficiencies have been brought to management's attention?
The newest one is really the track plate deficiencies. That's the newest one. When we had our consultant out there looking at the remedy that the contractor went on his own, and we're going to talk about that, we learned of gaps in plates, and that's the newest deficiency that's been added.
So otherwise, most of these have been out there and known for?
Correct.
6 months, 8 months, something like that?
Correct.
Thank you.
In June 2015, Metro and Airport Authority staff observed cracks in the pre-stressed concrete Florida I-beam girders of the aerial guideway structure that had started to arrive on site for installation. In this photo, you can see the girders. Those are the horizontal elements and the piers of the aerial guideway as it curves towards Dulles Airport Station. As a point of information, this was the first use of Florida I-beam girders in the region. Analysis was performed to assess if these cracks resulted from structural deficiencies. The analysis was also performed to develop design revisions to reduce or eliminate cracking in the girders yet to be cast and to establish suitable repair techniques. All the cracks in the girders were accepted and for use and have been repaired, and the girders will be thoroughly reinspected prior to Metro's acceptance of the project. And we have been inspecting it throughout the project, and we haven't seen any new cracks come about. Next slide. Next, in regards to the Dulles Airport Station screen walls, pedestals in question are installed on top of the concrete piers in the station. These piers also support the trackway and platform above. One of the piers is visible in the larger photo, which is taken at the mezzanine level of the station. The pedestals are not readily visible in this picture. These cast-in place pedestals were intended to support bearings for the attachment of structural framing for the station screen walls that you can see in the smaller section view, that small photo in the bottom right-hand corner. During repair of cracks observed at these pedestals, it was discovered by the contractor that the pedestals were constructed without proper internal reinforcement and that inserted anchor bolts had been inappropriately modified. As noted here, the contractor developed an alternative attachment detail that does not rely on the pedestals for primary support of the bearings. The alternative detail has been reviewed and accepted by Metro and the Airports Authority, and work is underway right now. Next slide. In April 2018, the Airport Authority notified its contractor of deficiencies with asphalt paving at Dulles Yard. As noted here, the contractor has acknowledged the deficiencies and corrective work has been agreed upon and will be completed. At this time, the work has not started because he has heavy equipment still on the property. He would like all the heavy equipment to be removed and then begin the repair of the asphalt, and we're satisfied with that. Next slide. There are several large bridge cranes to be located in the service and inspection building at Dulles Yard. One of the bridge cranes that has already been installed is shown here in the photo on the right. Concerns were raised by the Airport Authority regarding information submitted by the manufacturer of the bridge crane certifying Buy America compliance. The contractor has subsequently provided additional documentation, and the Airport Authority has determined the cranes are compliant. Gaps are required in the running rail to support the separation of track circuits for signaling purposes. Insulated joints provide these gaps while providing structural continuity of the running rail. In the photos, you can see the gap in the rail and the epoxy and bolted bars that provide the structural continuity. IJs are typically inspected visually for soundness of insulation and also tested with a voltmeter to ensure that there is no leakage of current. Two issues have been identified with the IJs in Dulles Yard. As you can see in the upper photo, rather than having precisely drilled and aligned holes through the bars and the rail sections being joined, the holes are oversized and some have been elongated. These are very significant. There are very significant forces on the IJ components, and such deficiencies are a significant concern, are not acceptable to Metro. Additionally, it's Metro's understanding that many IJs in Dulles Yard have failed testing to ensure the isolation of current. This is also a significant concern and must be addressed before we accept the yard. The contractor is in the process of replacing the IJs to address the structural deficiencies, and after the IJs have been replaced, the IJs will be retested to ensure electrical isolation. Precast concrete wall panel cracks at Dulles Yard building. In the September of 2018, Metro staff observed cracks at the precast wall panels of the buildings in Dulles Yard. Just to clarify, these panels were produced by a different subcontractor than those at the stations. Testing and analysis conducted by the Airport Authority and its contractor confirmed that the panels are structurally sound. The Airport Authority and the contractor concluded that the cracking is the result of the panel connections to the building structure restraining thermal and shrinkage movement of these panels. The cracking is concentrated at the lower area of the panels near where attachment to the floor slab occurs. To address the possible infiltration of moisture that could impact the durability of the panels, the contractor has proposed the application of a pigmented sealer that is able to bridge the narrow cracks. This will address the infiltration of moisture as well as cosmetically concealing cracks. In the photos, you can see a section of one of the buildings where the panels occur, as well as a detail showing one of the crack gauges installed to monitor for any change in the width of the crack. And we've had 2 years already. We have not seen a change in those cracks. Metro is currently working with the airport authority and the contractor on review of and approval of a specific sealer product, application procedures, and reapplication requirements. The Metro Office of the Inspector General is also conducting a review of this issue. The contractor has acknowledged that they are having difficulty achieving compliance with the required track gauge through switches in Dulles Yard. 39 switches in the yard have tight gauge ranging from 56 inches to 56 and 3/8 inches rather than the 56 and a half inch gauge, which is required by our spec and is standard across the industry. Tight gauge can cause wheel climb, which is the basis for statements made by the airport authority that this could result in a derailment. The contractor continues to perform remedial work, including repositioning of switch ties, and is coordinating with the switch manufacturer to identify further corrective actions they can take. Metro believes that the contractor will ultimately be able to achieve compliance without the incorporation of non-standard features. Metro will not accept the Dulles Yard if this issue is not resolved. In the contractor's review to identify the cause for the ability to achieve compliant cross level at special track work, it was identified that some of the concrete ties on the project exceeded the camber requirements of the contract. We will discuss the cross level issue later in the presentation. Analysis was performed by Metro's consultant determined that although not compliant with contract requirements, the range of camber present would not impact the structural integrity of the concrete switch ties. The contractor has indicated that they have recast and replaced 248 of the concrete switch ties, that's approximately 10% of the ties, that have excessive camber in efforts to address the cross-level deficiency, but some non-compliant concrete switch ties remain in place. Another deficiency that has recently been identified by Metro's consultant in a follow-up investigation of the cross-level issue is that a high percentage of the special track work plates do not meet the flatness requirements that are in the contract. The track work plates exhibit an upward curvature that results in a gap at the middle of the plate between the bottom of the plate and the top of the concrete tie to which it is attached. In addition to being out of compliance with the contract requirements for flatness, some of the gaps created by the curvature of the plate are of a magnitude that could result in long-term fatigue problems. Metro will require replacement of all track plates where gaps could result in fatigue failure. The contractor was not able to achieve compliance in the contract requirements for cross-level tolerance at special work track work throughout the ballasted area of phase two alignment. The maximum cross-level deviation from zero allowed is an eighth inch plus or minus. The observed condition is that the frog center area is higher than the outer rails. Originally, the cause of the contractor's inability to achieve compliance with the cross-level tolerance was identified by the contractor as being concrete switch ties that had excessive camber. It was subsequently concluded by the airport's authority and the contractor that fewer of the concrete ties exceed the tolerance for camber than originally thought, and that other issues are contributing to or causing the contractor's inability to achieve compliant cross level. The cross level deficiencies are not uniform within a given turnout and also are unique from turnout to turnout. Without having reached consensus on the cause of the cross level deficiencies, the contractor implemented a remediation intended to achieve compliance. The remediation includes deviations from the approved design, including the use of thinner pads under the frog plates, thicker rail pads, and a variety of custom fabricated thicker guardrail plates in lieu of the specified 3/4 inch thick plates that were originally in the design. Metro concludes that the remediation implemented by the contractor to address cross-level deficiencies introduces unnecessary, difficult, and complex maintenance requirements. The complexity and uniqueness of each fastener configuration would introduce an unacceptable risk that these fastener configurations would not be replicated exactly during future maintenance work. This could result in a track geometry, in the track geometry becoming out of tolerance, and such out of tolerance issues could lead to a reduction in the useful life of the components, component failures, and potential revenue impacts at a later date.
Ballast that has too high a percentage of finer material, or what we call fines, is considered to be fouled. The presence of excessive fines can reduce the ballast ability to drain freely and hold the track in place. In February of 2018, the Airport Authority notified the contractor that there are many areas of track bed that have been that have concentrated fines instead of consistently graded stone. The Airport Authority identified this condition of foul ballast as unacceptable. Agreement was reached between Metro and the Airport Authority on the maximum percentage of finer particles that would be accepted for in-place ballast. This is expressed in the terms of fouling index and the agreed upon threshold of the fouling index was 6, and that is the standard across the industry. Sampling and testing was performed by the Airport Authority at 97 locations in the yard. 41 of the 97 locations were identified as exceeding the agreed upon fouling index. The contractor performed remedial work to address areas of foul ballast, but Metro expressed concern that the contractor's effort had not been comprehensive. Additional testing by the Airport Authority and visual inspection by Metro suggest that there are other areas of foul ballast and a more thorough survey of the yard needs to be done. The Office of the Inspector General has also conducted a review of the ballast deficiencies in the yard, and the OIG recommends a complete survey and testing of the entire ballast in the yard to determine the gravity and the breadth of the problem. Accordingly, Metro intends to hire a third-party consultant to conduct this survey and testing. In May 2017, the contractor advised of potential water-cement ratio issues with precast concrete panels at the grade stations. Other quality issues were later identified, including low air contact content and insufficient concrete covering the reinforcing steel. These deficiencies are all known to be detrimental to the service life and durability of the precast concrete, particularly given the conditions of exposure. The stations, located in the medium of two major highways, will be exposed to chlorides and spray from roads treated with de-icing solutions. The Airport Authority contractor proposed the application of a saline sealer to all the station precast concrete panels, which, if properly maintained, would prevent critical saturation of the concrete and associated freezing and thawing damage. This solution was accepted by Metro, subject to working out the details of the application, warranty provisions, reapplication frequency, and testing requirements. From information received in May of 2018 regarding the federal lawsuit against the fabricator of the precast panels, Metro learned of a potential fourth deficiency related to the aggregate used in the concrete mix. The aggregate was not the approved aggregate and has a higher potential for alkali silica reaction reactivity, also known as ASR. Metro advised the airport's authority that this new information causes Metro to reassess the adequacy of the proposed remediation, and the Metro Office of the Inspector General became involved in the investigation at this time. The Airport Authority and its contractor elected to proceed with the application of the saline sealer. The Airport's Authority and the contractor believe this will address the potential ASR issue. The OIG conducted a thorough review of the extensive amount of documentation regarding these precast concrete panels and has observed the contractor's application of the saline sealer. On August 13, 2019, the OIG received information from the contractor indicating that 20% of the 25 concrete cores that were tested for depth of penetration of the saline sealer failed to achieve sufficient penetration. Based on this and other information as known today, the OIG has recommended that Metro not accept the application of the saline sealer or other solutions short of complete replacement of the concrete panels. In summary, Metro has not set a target service date until all the identified deficiencies have been resolved. Today, we wait for the Airport Authority's response to the unresolved deficiencies, and based on their response, this will determine the path forward and the timing for Metro's acceptance or rejection of the project. Once Metro has established a revenue date, we will be coming back to the board not only for approval of the project, but also for additional money that would be needed for startup costs. And with that, that concludes my remarks regarding the update, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lederer. That's a very comprehensive and shocking presentation. You've run through a dozen construction deficiencies on the Silver Line Phase 2 project, and it would seem to place a very dark and foreboding cloud over the July of next year startup date that the Airport Authority is talking about. Before we begin the questions, I'd like to ask the Inspector General or the Chief Safety Officer whether they want to add anything to management's presentation.
I'll defer to the Inspector General.
Thank you. You're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. If you'd indulge me just for a moment, I'd like to put into perspective how the OIG became involved. In July of 2018, the general manager asked me to do an independent probe of the Silver Line construction, mostly on the concrete, but any other issues that we may have identified. I then asked Mr. Feblis to take charge of that and to hire an independent consultant that was in no way conflicted with Metro. We then procured the services of Mr. Tipping, who's here today. On August 10th and August 16th, we issued two management alerts to Mr. Wiedefeld and management, discussing both the ballast and the concrete spray issues. And management alert is the vehicle that we use to notify management of impeding important issues before any sort of final OIG report, be it any report, is issued. And at this point, if you have any specific questions, I'll defer to Mr. Feblis and Mr. Dibby.
Thank you. Okay. Let's get started with some questioning. I just want to note that alternate member Hudgens from Virginia is on the phone participating by conference call. Other members are, of course, physically here other than Mr. Horner, who is recused. I think what we'll do is let me start with a few questions, and then we'll have questions from other members of the committee, Mr. Bulger, Mr. Rouse, and Mr. Smedberg, and then we'll open it up to the other members of the board that are present today. Mr. Lederer, as I gather from both your presentation as well as the letters that were sent out last Friday to the Airport Authority and the construction team, the three biggest issues that are of concern to you right now are the precast concrete panels at the five above-ground stations, number one. Number two, the fouled ballast in the Dulles rail yard. And third, the cross-level track deficiencies at the 29 mainline turnouts that are related to the issue of the tie camper and the track plate curvature. Could you just explain why those are the three issues of greatest concern to management, if that is a correct summary of the issues of greatest concern at this point in time?
I think those relate right to safety concerns that we would have. When you have a precast concrete panel and you can't see inside it once a sealer is applied, you don't know when that's going to break or become damaged to a point where it's got to be replaced. The ballast issue, really, when you look at a yard scenario, there should be very limited maintenance that goes into a yard operation. Having foul ballast will eventually lead to pumping, mud spots, and if they are not stayed up on top of, they will lead to derailment conditions. Again, I go back to this is the time now to fix it. Before you start putting trains in that yard, okay, and affecting the operation from a safety perspective, this is the time to fix it, as well as the cross level. I am very concerned with the curvature plates. The fact that they don't meet the flatness criteria that was established in the specifications of the contract, that if those plates fail underneath the frog, that is a derailment condition waiting to happen. And to identify broken plates under the frog can be difficult. So those are three safety concerns I have, and I think this is the time to fix it before we open up operations.
On the safety issues, there's the one you're just talking about with the cross-level deficiencies with the 1/8 inch difference, could that result in a train rollover, or what other concerns would you have on the operation of the actual Metro Rail system if these deficiencies aren't corrected and remediated before Metro takes possession?
From a cross-level perspective, an eighth inch is not going to cause a derailment condition. It's the underlying issues that we are concerned with that are safety-related, and those are the curvature plates, the fact that we have a non-standard switch on the main line, and each switch is unique to itself, which is going to require more maintenance and inspection than what would normally be provided. So from a cross-level perspective, plus or minus an eighth inch from zero tolerance is a standard across the industry for new construction. That's what you're building to for new construction. When you look at cross-level from a maintenance perspective, okay, that cross-level can increase, okay, and what that does, it determines the type of maintenance and the actions you take. So as your cross-level becomes higher, okay, you may have to put a slow speed in or take immediate action. So from a derailment perspective of an eighth inch, I'm not concerned. It's the underlying issues that are causing the eighth inch or the contractor not able to obtain the zero cross level or plus or minus an H. Those are the issues that I am really concerned with.
Thank you.
Just, Mr. Chairman, if I may just add, on the panels, one of the concerns there is all the work that's being done on those panels today is being done in a greenfield environment. You know, we'll be operational, and as we have to deal with these issues under an operational environment, it's totally different than what you deal with today. So that's a concern of ours, both in terms of maintenance, the impact obviously would have on the revenue potentially, but also on revenue. And same way with some of the other major issues, whether it's the ballast or the mainline rail, is that if we have to do more frequent maintenance, that means we get issues in terms of late night service or midday work, whatever that may take to deal with that. So that is our concern, is that should take so many years before we get to that stage, and we don't want to start off at that level at a brand new project.
Thank you. That's actually a good segue into the question I was going to ask you about the concrete panels at the five above ground stations. And let me just play devil's advocate. I guess the question I want to ask is, why can't the remediation be considered the additional application of the saline sealers be done once phase two is accepted by WMATA and we're actually running trains and people are walking in and out of the stations in revenue service? What's the risk to doing that once we take possession?
So the applying of the sealant is not an easy thing. So you have to have proper weather conditions. The panels have to be power washed. You have to come back. Some of them are right on the platform where passengers walk. So it would be almost impossible to do that while there are people there. As Mr. Wiedefeld said, you'd have to close the platform. You have to do it at night, different things like that. So,
thank you. I appreciate that clarification. Mr. Snowberg?
Mr. Goldman, before we move on, I just want to clarify one point. Ms. Hudgens is actually listening into the meeting through WMATA.com. And actually not on the phone, so and not participating. So we just wanted to, right, we just wanted to get that on the record.
Mr. Rouse?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I guess I would be remiss if I did not say welcome to Ms. Impastato. Obviously, having worked together over the years, I think it was a little disheartening to see you lose your CSO after you'd started getting your feet under you after the issues over the past few years, but I was happy to see that somebody with the experience of Ms. Impastato is in here, and not only that, she's very proactive. And that's something you need in a CSO position. You need somebody who's willing to go on their own and make sure the system's running safely. So welcome to WMATA from that. Obviously, in terms of phase two, again, the track issues stand out to me the most, and maybe that's because I'm biased because of some of my background. But it's also because it has the biggest impact on the operations of the agency here. And you know, anyone who's dealt with switch issues, and even those who ride Metro every day and get that little notice that say, hey, we have a switch problem outside of whatever station, you know how your heart kind of drops and goes, okay, here we go, right? So we don't need that, right? And that's part of the reason you pay for concrete turnouts. They're more precise, and they're hopefully more reliable and easier to maintain. And so starting off day one, behind the curve is not a good thing. And so I think that's something that really needs to be addressed by all the parties appropriately here, because it does have an enormous impact on how this operation will fall out over the next few years. And, yeah, trying to maintain different turnouts with different plates and different configurations, that's only going to lead to more problems. If I was a Class 3 railroad and you gave me those turnouts, I'd be perfectly happy running 10 miles an hour over them every day. But this is a high-performance transit system, and so we should expect better. We should expect attention to detail from the products we're paying for. So I think that's something that stands out to me as one of the more critical issues that has to be addressed. And, you know, along with lines with anything that we have that might impact long-term maintenance costs, too often with these projects, I've said you wait till it becomes a punch list resolution item and you find major issues, and then you try to resolve them, and it only ends up with further delay to the project and more cost and litigation, and sometimes you never get it resolved in a way that people are happy about. And so I think you're doing the right thing here by addressing these now, rather than waiting until we're starting to run trains and doing testing, because if you look at something like the turnouts just by themselves, if you've ever tried to remove a single concrete tie from track that's in service, those of you who have ever done that know that it's not an easy task, especially when the ballast is already set. Now try doing that with, what, is it 22.5-foot tie or something of this nature? I mean, just think of the weight alone and the ability to get that out of there if you needed to do a replacement. It's just, the idea is that you don't do that. You do that now when there's nothing running. It's right. It lasts you, you know, 30 to 50 years with minimal work on it. So I think you're doing the right thing here by being proactive and trying to get on top of these issues. You know, same thing with the panels and other areas where we've worked very diligently with our funding partners to be, you know, coherent and adhere to our budget and stay on top of that. And this sort of, these are the types of things that can add up over time and be unexpected capital and operation costs that people don't see right now, but suddenly we have to address it 5 years from now. So, and being fully transparent, as someone that commutes from Ashburn every day, you know, I want to see this line open as much as anybody, right? And so I don't think it's a matter of, you know, rushing just to the fact of getting it open and getting in service there. We need to do it correctly so that it's, you know, fulfilling the need for this area, but it's also doing so in a manner that's doing our fiduciary duty to the funding partners of this area as well. So I do think you're on the right path here. Certainly work with MWA. This is probably one of the more unique construction contracts in the country. I mean, most times you have control over the contractor or the prime contractor. This is not the case, so it's going to be interesting, and I would encourage you to continue working with MWA on figuring out a solution that works for all parties, and certainly if there's parallel paths that can be worked out while we do testing or other things, that's certainly encouraged, but yeah, I think we need to identify these issues now and resolve them before it gets too far down the path. So,
thank you, Mr. Rousseau. We're very fortunate to have you participating in this Safety and Operations Committee meeting today. Perhaps for the benefit of my other colleagues in the public, you might just identify what is your position at the FRA, Federal Railroad Administration, and your expertise in this area.
Certainly. So, you know, as Director of Passenger Rail Division, I'm in charge of the safety for the nation's commuter and intercity passenger rail. So that has everything to do from operations to maintenance to writing regulations about equipment to maintaining track, and then also one part of my duty is working with all the new starts out there in this country. So any operation that's going to start an extension to a line or even start a line from scratch, we work with them over the years. And so I've been fortunate enough to see a lot of these projects over the years and see how people address them. And I think one thing that is often missing is proactively addressing some of these items now before they start running test trains. All too often you're up against the last 2 weeks of testing, and that's when you're trying to resolve these critical issues, and that's when you fall into even further and further delays for a project. And so, you know, there may be some apprehension now because it might affect the date now, but I can tell you you'll be much better off addressing the issues now than trying to address them a year from now. So other than that, background is in track engineering and also equipment. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for a very revealing report. This is deja vu for me with the Silver Spring intermodal facility, but this is way bigger than what we tackled at Silver Spring. Putting aside future litigation, which the Silver Spring project went through, is it, in your estimation, a good thing to start thinking about a sinking fund for all of this remuneration that we're looking at down the road?
Our position is that, again, we want a product from day one that meets the standards and the contractual terms. So I think that's what we want to focus on now, getting the product that we all expected to have delivered.
Oh, in other words, we're gonna go to the warranty when we accept this project. No.
What we're asking for is that the standards that were set forth in the contract be met, and that the Airports Authority continue to work with our contractor to deliver what was expected to be delivered.
Okay. Short of guessing that is the case, should this board consider recommending a reserve fund, a sinking fund?
I think it's too soon.
Okay.
General, just to summarize your position, it would be by analogy, if you were buying a house, you'd want the contractor to deliver to you a house that didn't have floors where you could run a bowling ball down from one end to the other, and you'd want landscaping that didn't have the potential to back up and flood your basement. Is that a fair, Mr. Smedberg?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Leader, a question for you. You have 12 items identified on this list here. Some are checked green is being resolved, yellow underway, red unresolved. But when I heard your presentation, there were some of the yellow items that to me, or what I heard, is that they're fairly serious issues. Is there any scenario where a yellow item could then become a red item?
Sure, if the contractor fails to place all the IJs that are failing. If they fail to correct the gauge, then they would become red items. But we believe they're moving towards a plan to get them remediated, so we left them as yellow.
Okay. So that's the difference. You feel if something is yellow, serious issue, but yet
correct,
they're on the path to being resolved,
correct,
hopefully. So that's the difference between yellow and red.
Yes.
Okay. And then you mentioned testing. Let's say most of these items are resolved, all these items are resolved to the satisfaction at some point down the road. How long is the testing period? I know you made reference to it a little bit, but
when I was talking about the testing, I think we were talking about retesting the IJs.
Yeah.
That's not a significant time period.
Okay.
But we have to make sure the work is done first and get back into the yard.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. I know all members of the committee may have other questions, but we'll just open it up for questions from other members of the board itself. Mr. Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Leader, projects of this size typically have issues. And how many of these items would you say are things that typically occur within a project that have to be addressed during the construction period? And which are the ones that you have a sense are?
I think there should have been better oversight on the concrete panels in the stations. And I think there should have been more of an investigation in the cross level before the contractor came up with a solution that really has just added more complexity to the overall problem. So I think those are typically things you would probably not see if there was good quality control over a project.
So that actually leads to my fundamental question. Given that you have issues that really speak to your concerns about the level of overall quality control, does that change the depths of other areas that we're going to really put a magnifying glass to? So we've identified the ballast issues, and it seems that at the rail yard there are extensive quality control problems. Does that then invite greater scrutiny on other elements, maybe the at-grade platforms where you certainly have ballast? Are we taking a closer look at that? I guess how much does this impact our trust that other things that we maybe wouldn't scrub so closely maybe need to be examined?
Again, we are involved in looking at all elements of the project. We'll continue to do that. If we find any, we'll bring them, you know, to attention. But I also think, as the OIG mentioned, that they sort of have a, you know, that they can go anywhere they want in terms of looking at issues. And so they may be going to other places. I don't know.
And could I ask just a brief other one? Thank you, Mr. Goldman. So maybe this is for Mr. Tipping. So with the concrete panels, I'm just curious, 5 of the 25 weren't able to be penetrated sufficiently. Do we have a sense as to what was going right with 20 of them and what was going wrong with the remaining 5?
Not at this point, I don't believe.
Okay.
The silane sealer solution anticipates a fairly uniform application of the product over the entire surface of the panel. There are some access issues. Parts of the panels require that the technician be on a ladder. There was a photograph of a technician on a lift to spray the surface. There are some areas where the distance between the panel and some other part of the structure actually prevents getting the spray nozzle into the proper location to properly apply the product. So one of the things that the contractor, I think, is struggling with is how you control the application rate for all parts of the panels. With regard to the testing that's been done, we don't know where the core samples were taken. So we don't know whether the ones that failed, for example, might have been in at a higher elevation where the potential for not getting as much product applied exists. So at this point, we really don't have an idea of what the problem is. That's something that I think CRC and the group that are applying the product are dealing with right now. And it's going to require that they evaluate not only the results from the test, but also the location where the samples were taken and whether or not ambient conditions or location or one other variable might have impacted their ability to properly apply the product.
Thank you. That's very helpful. So if I could sort of encapsulate, tell me if I've got it right. So the silane solution as it's been offered, we don't yet know whether it's an issue with the product itself, the sort of chemical solution, or the difficulties in applying it in a way that produce maximum effectiveness. And then 2, we haven't actually had any kind of testing on this solution in any sort of simulated weatherized conditions or atmospheric conditions that are going to be able to tell us how it's going to hold up over time. Are all those things true?
No.
No, okay. All right.
The product itself, I think, is not a question.
Okay.
The effectiveness of the product is not an issue.
Okay.
The ambient conditions are less of an issue because there are some restrictions temperature-wise and you know, how many days past rain you have to experience before you apply the product. So the ambient conditions, I think, are probably a possible problem, but I think less of an issue than the application rate itself. My observations on site were that they were using, they would start at the bottom of the panel and work up, and the application rate was such that product was running down the face of the panel. So as you work your way to the top of the panel, it stands to reason that the bottom portions of the panels are going to receive more product than the upper portions. And that's aside from the access issues that they're dealing with.
Got it.
May I add one more thing? So with regards to the testing of the 25 cores, what happened was they tested the, and from what has been communicated to us, they tested the panels for water penetration. And so what happened was when you say the 20% are not sufficient, the water penetrated the cores to the point where if there could be a reaction, there would be at that point. And so that's the problem where we stand right now. The contractor has told us that they're going to provide more application to the panels. We don't know if that's going to work, and that also brings into question whether there's additional cost involved when Metro takes that project over.
And I promise, Mr. Goldman, just the final one I think will be quick. So what's the length of time that it takes to actually test one of these areas for water penetration? Is this something that's incredibly invasive or can be done with revenue service operating?
So I can tell you this. We began looking at this thing in September of 2018. August of 2019, this past August, is when we got the results. What happened was there were situations where they were going to spray or they power washed and then it rained. And so they had to repower wash, wait a couple of days, apply it again. And so imagine doing that over 1,500 panels, the spray. Once they got it sprayed, and they have to do, the manufacturer recommended two coats. So you'd spray the first coat, you can wait, I think, as much as 15 minutes and then reapply. So then when they reapplied, they needed to wait a certain 7 or 8 days for it to get in there and then take the core samples again. So we finally got the 25 cores, I want to say approximately sometime this spring or summer, and then the testing occurred and we got the results in August. So it took a bunch of months before we finally got, and we do not have, just so I can say, we do not yet have a final report. We've asked for it, and we've also asked for the results of the testing separately to see what those testing, what happened with the testing. We did also request, because of the hard-to-reach areas, that they put a mock panel out by the airport and spray it once, sort of simulating that it didn't get the full penetration, and then take core samples there. We did that, and from what I'm advised, it didn't penetrate either with one spray, which brings a lot of concern in those hard-to-reach areas. What assurance do we have that there will be proper spraying to ensure that there's no penetration?
I was hoping that this line of questioning would make me feel better about the concrete panels. It has not.
I knew what
apologize.
You were going, and I knew what the result would be.
Sorry.
Mr. McMillan.
And as you related that saga of the past 12 months, it makes me think what the saga of the next 30 to 50 years might be of the path we're on. Mr. Chivang, perhaps you know, this product, given a choice, my understanding is the manufacturer suggests an application on a horizontal surface rather than vertical, that on a horizontal surface, the product can sit there and penetrate rather than you spray it, and before gravity has made it run down to the bottom, it actually has a real chance of penetrating. Is that correct, that's
yes.
The ideal way of applying this product?
And yes, sir.
Now that the panels are in place, that's not much of an option, so we're left with this saga that we just heard about. Next question, I want to maybe draw this, a comparison to this and the previous presentation we had in this room. The Mr. Wiedefeld, if we had a situation in one of these phase two stations where the platform height and the height of the floor of the rail car had a gap of, say, 3 to 4 inches, the process we're going through now would probably have identified that error, correct? Okay. If, for example, we had some concrete pours where, you know, either the configuration of the rebar within the concrete or the inadequacy or lack of protection against water intrusion put that concrete at risk of compromise within a 10 to 20 year period, the process we're going through now should identify those types of potential concerns, right?
Yes.
Okay. So just, you know, for everybody who took shuttle buses this summer, or as I did, had to struggle through traffic as my home station was closed down for 3 months, that's exactly what we're trying to avoid with this type of scrutiny for the people at the end of the Silver Line. You know, as, again, we discussed in the previous committee meeting, these big, heavy, disruptive projects, expensive projects, are sometimes necessary when you aren't doing the proper work of maintenance in between. But what the platform project really drove home to me as we reviewed that a couple weeks ago, getting it right at the front end, before you've accepted it, before you've started rail revenue service, before you put people on these things, is critically important. And so I compliment the scrutiny that this team is applying to phase two here.
Thank you. A question for Mr. Charrington. The Inspector General is reported in the Post to have said that the present station panels and the fouled ballast, the two issues that the IG has investigated, are the three big ones. And I'll quote what the Post says, will create extraordinary cost, maintenance, and operational issues early once WMATA takes ownership and control of this project. So I guess my question to the Inspector General, is that an accurate summary of the IG's position? And then my question to Mr. Lederer is that the management's position as well?
Mr. Chairman, first a clarification. We posted our management alerts on the website, and the media then takes those from the website. Yes, sir, that is an accurate depiction of our management alert, which was reported and then reported by the Post. Yes, sir.
Would that be management view as well?
Absolutely.
That would be a similar concern of ours, but also an added concern to ours would be the potential, and again, from a funding partner perspective, is the potential loss of revenue. Because if we have to go out through new works, like the platform work, you know, it's not only the work that we're doing, but we're actually losing revenue at the same time. So, you know, this is, it gets compounded if these aren't issues aren't addressed.
Thank you. Other questions, members of the committee? Mr. Rouse, Mr. Bolger, Ms. Medberg, Mr. Rouse.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two quick issues. And first, I think Director Ron brought up a good point on how common some of these issues are that you found. And, you know, and to put a little bit of context out there for the track work itself, the special track work, typically you would expect that contractor, when they're doing it in their own facility, pouring the ties and then assembling the rail, to check to make sure it meets spec before they ship it, because that's when you can actually remedy the issues and, if you need to, re-pour ties. So having that not occur does raise some issues as to how this was, what oversight was applied and how we got to this point. But that aside, on slide 18, one point I don't understand is the application of the sealer in terms of how it would affect the issue that was found in terms of insufficient cover of the rebar. Can anyone speak to that?
There are several issues that are sensitive to moisture. The distance of reinforcing from the nearest surface of the concrete becomes more problematical if it's closer, because the water can penetrate through the pore spaces in the concrete, and in combination with that, oxygen cause corrosion of the reinforcing. When reinforcing corrodes, it expands and the concrete surface would spall. Other issues that were intended, that are intended to be addressed by the silane sealer, are the higher water cement ratio, which for some of the panels, which results in a more porous concrete and makes it easier for water to penetrate the concrete. Lower entrained air content. Entrained air in a freeze-thaw environment is intended to give water, once it does penetrate the concrete, to give the water a place to expand without damaging the concrete. So if you don't have the air bubbles there to hold the water, then there's a potential for damage there. The alkali silica reaction is one that depends on moisture in terms of the alkali in the cement and the reactive aggregate. Once moisture is made available, then the reactive aggregate actually expands and causes damage to the physical damage to the concrete. So all of these issues that have been identified are able to be remedied by the proper application and maintenance of the silane sealer. It's agrophobic, aquaphobic. Anyway, it resists water infiltration. And actually, water should stand on the surface. And that's why the coverage is so critical, to make sure that you have the right amount of product applied to prevent water infiltration.
So the thought is there's enough coverage that other means of failure or failure modes are not of concern so much as the reactive to water, reactivity to water.
Right. The penetration of water is what we need to prevent, or what needs to be prevented to make all of the things that have been discovered non-problems. And so that's where the focus needs to be, is to make sure that the application is even and that it's well maintained.
Thank you.
Mr. Tipping, I'm curious. You have a lot of experience, obviously. Have you worked with this product or seen this product used before? The sealant you're talking about?
With this particular product, this
yes.
brand,
mm-hmm.
no. But with silane sealers, they're manufactured by a number of different companies and are routinely used for bridge maintenance, for example,
okay.
To prevent water infiltration.
So if there is proper application, despite variances in certain panels with the amount of water to concrete mix ratio or whatever, is there a life expectancy of that sealant? What's the life expectancy if everything is done properly?
The warranty that has been agreed to by, that was agreed to by the three different companies that were considered was 10 years. A reapplication would be anticipated either at 10 years or sometime within that warranty period.
Okay. And from your experience, despite you haven't worked with this particular product that they're using, is that something you've seen, that 10 years is a good sort of benchmark?
The conversations that I've had with other manufacturers indicate that a 5 to 7 year reapplication rate is more likely.
Because of failure or just good practice?
The reapplication would be dictated by testing that would indicate the product is becoming less effective. So the reapplication would bolster what is in place at the time of the reapplication.
Okay.
Mr. Letter, I have a final question regarding the last slide of your presentation, the summary slide. As I walk through the summary slide, the airport authority has a July 20th projected start of service date right now. And if you walk that back, that means that they would have to declare the project substantially complete, if my math is right, by February 16, 2020. And today's September 12th, so that's 5 months off. I guess my question to you is, what would have to be done in these 5 months on the three big construction deficiencies issues that we talked about, the concrete panels, the ballast, and the track issues, for you to be comfortable that the project was substantially complete?
The cross level needs to be met.
Yeah.
The ballast needs to be clean, and the panels, based on the OIG's work, has to be solved. Obviously, we could take over panels that are failing at 20%, and you just heard the maintenance issues that we would be addressing if it was applied everywhere, but we'd be facing, much less if we had panels that we didn't even know if they're covered.
Yeah. And I'll just add to that, as Paul mentioned, it's just not a resolution to the deficiencies. The work would have to be complete.
Yes.
Would have to be complete by February.
Yeah. I'm not a construction engineer. I'm not an expert on this certificate. It seems to me that that's a lot that has to get done.
May I add something to that? Sorry.
Yes, sir.
We're also heading into fall and winter.
Well, that's
the application of that stuff is, you know, it took us this long to get the ones we did. So.
Yeah, you're underscoring my point that that might be a bridge too far to expect to be able to get done in 5 months, Mr. Snyder.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Well, Renee, while we're on this, I was going to ask you offline, or you or Mr. Tipping, but what are the temperature parameters or humidity levels for application? I was sort of curious about that because I had the same thought going into fall and winter, and spring tends to be pretty rainy. Obviously, the window is pretty short, I assume.
So I don't want to say. I know there is one, and I just don't know it off the top of my head. There is a degree number that if it gets below that, you cannot spray. But you also have to think about rain, wind, snow. If any of those conditions happen and you've power washed, then you have to start all over again, repower wash. And then let's say you just are lucky enough to power wash and have great weather this fall, then you have to take pre-cores and post-cores after the spray, and then you have to get those tested.
Thank you. I'd just like to thank Mr. Letter, the manager, and everybody else expert for their presentation. For my fellow board members, I just want to put you on notice that ultimately, as you saw from one of the early slides, we have to actually vote to accept this project and include it in the adopted regional system plan, something that will come before us before revenue service actually begins. So we have a role in this process somewhere down the line, and I suspect it's somewhere down the line that's different than what the airport authority thinks the start date. But I thank you again for your presentation. We ask the general manager to please keep us advised and let us know what is a likely timeline as it changes in the coming months, where the project might be at a stage where you could consider it substantially complete. And from that, what might be a revenue start date for Silver Line Phase 2. Thank you very much. With no further business to come before this committee, we stand adjourned. The Ethics Committee will begin a meeting in this room shortly.